the world as such is not evil. You take the Old Testament, and God created this, that, and the other, and He saw that it was good. If you take that statement as it stands, and take the Buddhist statement as it stands, the two are in direct opposition, in an irreconcilable opposition. But if one sees that the world as apprehended by us and our response, or more accurately, our uncontrollable reaction to the world is full of confusion, born of our ignorance, and therefore is evil, leads to what we experience as evil. This is a very different thing. A stone is a stone. How can it be evil? A frog is a frog. Man is a man. Rose is a rose, and a thorn is a thorn. But the way we apprehend them, and the way we react to them, that is what makes us experience them as pleasant or painful, good or evil. Isn't that so? Now, it is very important to realize this. Now, it has been possible because the world is good, essentially, in its innermost nature. It is good. It is godly, so to say. You see? Because of that, it is possible for us to grow, to become aware in a living, creative sense of the transcendent realm. Otherwise there would be no means whatsoever, if all this is evil forever and ever, there'd be no amen to follow it. But we must realize this. The world as apprehended by us is dukkha. When there is enlightenment, there is no such thing as dukkha, there is no such thing as the path. There is no conflict between samsara and nirvana. The two become identical. Therefore, this awakening and realizing transcendence enables us to know with an intimate knowing that the transcendent real negates what we see and experience in the world. It negates the way, the manner in which we see and experience the world. Totally negates it. Therefore, we don't ask questions, if we are wise, as to what is the transcendent, or how shall I picture the transcendent, or anything like that. When I myself have become free of my confusions and my limitations, then this which we commonly call the mind, having become totally empty, having ceased altogether to offer any obstruction to the transcendent, allows the transcendent to manifest completely through the man, and therefore it can be said of the man, just as God said of the light, it is good. You see, if then we are to understand, begin to have a glimmer of this comfort, the strength, this virya, as the Buddha called it, we will see that it has no relationship whatsoever with our Kamana Garden experience and conception of strength, which is a force put out in opposition to, a force used in order to bring about a result desired by the mind. It has no relationship to that. That strength doesn't do anything. That strength, that transcendent strength, never exerts itself either for or against. Now, if we can realize that, we have the answer, haven't we, to this awful problem which shatters some people's minds. If there is a God, why does he do nothing about the terrible evil in the world? If he is omnipotent, omniscient, how is it possible for evil to enter at all into our life, leave alone triumph? But there's the answer. One has to see deeply into this. The transcendent has no need to take sides. The transcendent knows no such thing as opposing sides. It is the totality. Is my right hand against my left hand? Is my kidney a bitter enemy of my heart? Are my lungs waiting to pounce upon my toes and eat them up? What is it? The totality, the total living universe, the one thing, the transcendent real. There is no taking sides involved in it. And although there is variety, uniqueness, distinctiveness, there is no otherness in our ordinary sense, in truth, in reality. In the actual physical universe, there is no otherness in that sense. Now you see, we can talk like this. And of course we begin with talking, with thinking, with thoughts. There is an impression upon us, upon our intellects. And we may accept a thing intellectual. And we accept it, usually, because it pleases the mind. The mind gets a pleasurable sensation. Oh, I like that sort of teaching. I like that kind of philosophy. I prefer it to this, that, or the other. Now, this is, of course, our weakness and our littleness. There is nothing to prefer. There is only total understanding which we must realize. So now, there is no such thing as otherness when there is the consciousness of transcendence. And it has to be a living consciousness, not a thought, not an idea, not something which I say or Jimmy Brown says or anybody else says, or what any scripture may have put out, or poetry, or whatever it is. It has to be a living consciousness, this freedom from the limitation of otherness. At the same time, recognizing the fact of variety. That is why I mentioned the different parts of the body. We know enough of our own living body to know that it is composed of organs which are different from each other, insofar as they are structured differently and have different functions. All right. But there is no otherness in this irreconcilable, unrelated sense between one organ and another organ in the body. It all forms part of one great whole. This is the important thing. Alright. Therefore, this strength in the religious, for the religious consciousness, in the context of the transcendent, is infinite resilience. There is no opposition. There is no taking sides. There is no conflict at all. And where this infinite resilience is concerned, there is no such thing as victory or defeat involved in it. This too we must realize in our innermost consciousness. Because you see, this is very intimately related to the other aspect of religious teachings about becoming free of tanha, for instance, our desires and this, that and the other. It's very intimately related to that. What is this freedom from desire? What is this thing which is prized so much, the quality of renunciation? Renounce this world and we shall win the world of the absolute, of God, of the transcendent and so on. These are unhappy ways of presenting the truth. The trouble is with the words, with the verbal formulation. And mind you, the trouble with the verbal formulation springs from our experience and our way of looking at things. That is not the way to look at it. Surely, there is a better way to look at it. This renunciation, this freedom from desire, is a natural giving way to the infinite resilience. Not because it is in opposition to me. Not because of that. But because it is the one and only reality that there is, of which I am part and parcel. Therefore I too am, or shall we say at least, have to be infinitely resilient. If I'm infinitely resilient, I let go. Let go what? My thoughts, my desires, my emotions, my ambitions, my envies, my jealousies, my virtues as well as my vices, my capacities, skills and techniques as well as my clumsiness and folly and ignorance and all that. I let it all go. Completely let it go. And you see what happens in consequence. This selfness, which is the hard core, out of which grows that weed of sorrow, disappears. It's gone. But it is a matter of realization. In consciousness, in the innermost depth of the consciousness, then when one knows that of course it is so, there is an of course-ness about it. Of course it is that. What else could it be? See? When we have come to that state of course-ness about the truth of the matter, then what has happened? Oneself is the truth. One doesn't acquire truth. One cannot, that's why Krishnamurti, for instance, always says, you cannot pursue truth. He always says that. You cannot pursue truth. You can pursue truth in the worldly context, in the worldly sense, where things are separated, they are docketed, they are pigeonholed, and everything belongs to its own sphere, and the meaning of truth in the worldly sphere is simply a statement in words which is an accurate representation of that which you see or touch or hear or experience. That is all. An event takes place, and according to the language you speak, the words of that language which you use accurately tell you what that event was. That is the meaning of truth. Now you can acquire the faculty of being truthful in that way. That is, and the acquisition of truth is possible. Historical facts, legal facts, mathematical facts, scientific facts, artistic facts, and so forth. Yes. Those can be pursued, they can be acquired, you can grow, and so forth. But where truth in this transcendent sense is concerned, which means that your living being from moment to moment is fully aware of the true nature of the moment and the total situation therein, that cannot be acquired. Acquisition has no place in it. It just doesn't apply to that context. This is what is so important, and this is where we so easily get confused. So many thousands of sincere people trying to live the religious life, merely walking round and round in Hampton Court maze, and just get nowhere. Therefore they think in terms of progress, of development, of achievement, of attainment, none of which apply to the transcendent reality. That is why in the Prajnaparamita, you do find in the Mahayana presentation that all these are just thrown out like that. The transcendent negates, totally negates our apprehension and the way we express and the way we react to this world. So that infinite strength, that infinite resilience, if we can realize that in our innermost consciousness, then the whole phenomenon of transcending one's desires, one's particular system of thought and philosophy and all the rest of it just naturally comes about. See, this is the marvel of the transcendent, of the infinite. This really gives us an insight into one of the deep meanings of Sri Krishna's statement, on whatsoever path a man approaches me, on that path do I meet him. We have considered this matter from this, starting from this point of view, from that point of view, from that point of view. At present we are considering it from this point of view of the Comforter, the Spirit of Truth, as Jesus called it, the Comforter, the Spirit of Truth. And comfort as meaning strength, this infinite resilience. And in the realization of that infinite resilience, the consequence is the whole thing is done. Whatsoever you do, for any one thing done in perfection, realized in perfection, means that the whole thing is realized in perfection. Because in the wholeness there is no separation. This is, if you like, real ground for hope in the sensible sense, not the wishful sense. What can you do but be hopeful? There is no option to the infinite hope, the perfect hope. You see? Having said that, suddenly reminds me, in this Chandogya Upanishad, that famous conversation between Narada and Sanat Kumara, you find hope mentioned. You all know the beginning of it because I have mentioned it over and over again, Narada goes to Sanat Kumara and so forth. And he proceeds to the next step. Narada asks, is there, sir, anything more than name, nama? Assuredly, says Sanat Kumara, speech is more than name. Then he says something about that. Then what is there, anything greater than speech? Assuredly, manas, mind is greater. Anything greater? Yes, assuredly, sankalpa. He's translated it as conception. But in this context, it's not conception in the strictly limited English meaning of the word conception, but sankalpa, a putting together in thought. More of that, a sort of a building up of a coherent philosophy of life or things. That's what's implied with the word sankalpa there. Anything greater than sankalpa? Oh, assuredly, chitta. He translates it as thought, which is not too good. Chitta is a word, particularly in the Buddhist context, it means mind in the broad sense, includes everything. But I prefer always to regard chit as mind at attention. Attentiveness, chitta. Then he goes on from there, that to dhyana, meditation, he translated it. The next one, vijnana, understanding. The next one, bala, strength. This comfort which we have been talking about. Anything more than that? Oh yes, says he, it's food. So that's a funny translation. Anna is assuredly more than strength. But here the Upanishad uses a little sort of esoteric language. Anna also means matter. If you want to go deeper, Anna means not just matter in the way in which we apprehend matter, but the essential substance of the universe. That which is, that which exists, that is Anna. You see? Anything more than Anna? Water, apas. Now this is a very difficult business. The term water, esoterically, has always been used for signifying the source of life. And you know, both in the Upanishads and in the first chapter of Genesis, you get the waters which are above the firmament and the waters which are below the firmament. In the Aitareya Upanishad, you get this business of the waters above. And they say that Brahma pushed the waters above the firmament after he had produced the waters under the firmament. Of course, you know, when things are put in that sort of language and we, 30 centuries later, read it, we get perplexed. It's difficult to understand. Anything more than water? Oh yes, heat. He's translated it as heat, tejas. Tejas means light, fire, brilliance. That is its essential meaning. Brilliance, tejas, is its essential meaning. It means light, when one lights up. And they use these words connected with the elements, prithvi, earth, apas, water, tejas, fire, etc., light or brilliance, vayu, air or wind, and akasha, which has been loosely translated as ether, really to signify certain profound states of consciousness in the deep meditations. That is what they really wanted to signify. I think Aurobindo Ghosh is about the only other person who has talked about this and said quite a bit. Anything more than akasha?
Memory, smara.
But this memory must not be thought of as a memory in our ordinary sense that I remembered this, that and the other. This is memory in the sense that Plato talks of. You know, the whole Pythagorean teaching that the soul which comes from beyond the zodiac, once it enters into our particular universal sphere, which is within the sphere of the zodiac is the ring pass not, actually. But when the soul comes through, it comes through the constellation of Krater, the cup. Krater, the cup which lies between Cancer and Leo, is it? Or Leo and Virgo. And anyhow, it's a little constellation which is there. And when it comes through that cup, it drinks of that drink which makes it forget its divine origin. This is the esoteric form in which the mystery schools of Greece presented it. And it forgets its divine origin. And therefore, the restoration of memory for the neophyte before he received, when he received his initiation, consisted in once again recalling his divine origin. As Zen calls it, his original face. You see? All right, memory. Anything more than memory? Yes. Hope. Asha. Hope. Well, if one remembers, brings back to mind one's divine origin, what option is there but to be thoroughly hopeful? You're all right. So you see, hope comes in there, in that sense. Anything greater than hope? He goes on, prana, life. Life. But not in the strictly biological sense, the life of the body or just that. Not just that, it's life in the transcendent sense altogether. The sense in which in this very same Upanishad earlier on they say Brahma is prana. Brahma is the void. Brahma is bliss. Life, the void, and bliss. Together. So you get all these different aspects coming in. And he goes on there quite a bit, and he ends up with the bliss aspect, joy. And wherein lies joy? In realizing the infinite, the transcendent. That's how the thing ends up. Where is this infinite transcendent? And Sant Kumar says that. It's above you, below you, in front of you, inside you, outside you, everywhere. Two outstanding consequences. One realizes that oneself is that the laid down path may have served us. In fact, the laid down path is at its stage indispensable. The trouble is that one sticks to the laid down path. One is afraid. It is, to give an analogy which I think is a fairly good analogy for this course, I climb up a ladder. But when I climb up that ladder, I must not feel that this ladder will be there always to support me. I must be prepared to kick the ladder off underneath me. And behold, I will not fall. I will fall,
is if I had not really seen into this infinite resilience, into this transcendence. If I had not seen into it, I will fall. Falling means that I will get confused. I will get giddy. And we do know of some instances, at least, where even great saints behave like giddy goats. See, time and again, they fell from grace. They fell from their heights. They gave way to desire, to this benefit. See, this comes again and again in so many stories in the Hindu Puranas about great saints who the gods send a nymph, an apsara, to tempt them. And of course, in every case, of course, the play has to work out nicely, you know, otherwise the audience won't pay. The jolly old saint, of course, undergoes a fall, you see, and he has wonderfully fine time with the apsara, usually 999 years, sometimes it goes to 9,999. Why they were fond of such figures, I don't know, but still, there we are. And then one day something happens and he suddenly wakes up, and then the usual denouement, you know, he says, "Out, thou temptress, out, out," you see, and once again he carries out his auspices and becomes a good fellow, and enters nirvana and all the rest of the claptrap. You see, you have that, you fall, one falls. Which simply means that one gets confused, and in that confused state, one is in bondage to desire. It is not that desire in itself is evil. Even desire is not evil. Even the devil is not evil. What is the significance of the fact that the devil is never slain? There is no theology in which the devil is wiped out of existence. Why not? This is it is very helpful to understand the deep significance of this. As I said earlier on, this, that and the other I call evil because out of my ignorance I do not understand it, I do not know how to respond to it. And therefore, I am in this state of confusion and think I complicate life, I complicate things in my own mind, and thereby evil comes into being. See? Right. So, one result is that I realize that the path is myself. When one realizes the transcendence, you yourself are the path. The Buddha put it in this form, that the Tathagata is the Dhamma become. He is the Brahma become. Dhamma Bhutam, Brahma become. Now how could you come? What more could he say? Just as Jesus said, my Father and I are one. Speak up. Well, you know, for instance, in Revelation, in the book of Revelation, it is said that the devil will be shut up for 1,000 years, but after that he'll be let loose again. You see? Now, why? If the devil represents evil, who wants evil to continue? No one. And yet, and at the same time, if God represents the omnipotent, the omniscient, the all good, the all perfect, How is it that with all that omnipotence, he can't just snap out the devil? Why doesn't he? See, the value for us with respect to this teaching lies here. It makes us probe into the inner meaning of this. This thing which we call evil emerges out of our own ignorant, confused state. There isn't an absolute evil as such. There isn't an absolute good as such in our intellectual sense. You see, we define good as the good is so and so. A Hottentot would say the good is so and so. A Pacific Islander, a Chinaman, a Russian, an Englishman, they'd all give different definitions of good. And similarly, we give different definitions of evil. What is the truth? You see, when one realizes transcendence, which is the truth itself, that is to say, the realizing of it, the seeing of it, is the truth. Not any form which we may give to that seeing, not a verbal formulation which we may give to that seeing and experiencing, but the actual experiencing, which is the truth. When that is there, our relative good and evil just vanishes just like that. You know, this is one of the very, very difficult problems which has defeated theologians through the centuries. Because, you know, they set out to produce an intellectual system. And they never could produce an intellectual system which was satisfactory, for the simple reason that they started off with certain fundamental assumptions of otherness. God, the world, man. Now, let us put the cogs and the nuts and bolts together and make the machine go. You can't. Why can't you? Because God, the world, and man are one single reality. Now, if you see that only intellectually, you can produce another wishy-washy intellectualist system, you see? But if you really see it in the inner depths of your consciousness, the whole problem has vanished. I am the problem. My confused state, my ignorance is the problem. The problem is not outside me. As if God, the world, man were three different things which I had to somehow or other patch up together. When this state of ignorance, this unclear state vanishes, then the problems vanish with it. Alright, so one realizes that oneself is the path, the living being. Jesus said, I am the way. Now of course, you see how that got misinterpreted by the theologians and the devout followers. At the back of their minds, they never penetrated into the depths of their own minds sufficiently. At the back of their minds was the idea, Jesus, who became the Christ, Christ Jesus, a separate being, God, the Father, a separate being, you see, incarnate in His Son, who showed us separate beings the way to realize a separate heaven, perfection, salvation, etc. See, the mind. It was unclear because it was chock-a-block filled up with ideas. Now you will say, anybody will quite legitimately ask, but how do you throw out your ideas? You can't throw out your ideas. No, you don't have to throw out your ideas. You have to stop clinging to them. You see, in our life in the world of things and manifestation, just as things are made, they are used, they break up, they are thrown away, put into the melting pot and perhaps reconstructed into other things. In the same way with the mind, we have certain ideas and we must not cling to them. If you cling to the old kettle which now has about 3 holes in it, well, it'll be a very long time before you get your tea. Don't cling to that old kettle, get a new one. Throw the old one out. Now in the same way with ideas, be ready to let them go. Because the living mind will inevitably manifest its life by putting forth ideas. You can't escape that as a fact. But by not clinging to the old idea, born out of my old, confused, ignorant state, I become free. Now this is the meaning of the emptying of the mind. Doesn't mean that you become a nitwit. You see, it's so unfortunate, so the bulk of the teachings of religion, of scripture, have been sort of explained in a nitwit manner. Really senseless manner. Well, mind you, it is difficult to get sense into it. You have to sort of devote your whole being to it. And if you really care for it, you will see it. So we get, I started off by saying 2 consequences of this complete giving way. You realize you yourself are the path, and that the mind becomes, has to become empty, luminous, transparent. And that this mind is not my mind as a property. It is not my mind as my property. There's no such thing. Only the brain in this body is part and parcel, as if it were the property of the body, which undoubtedly it is. Just as your kidney or liver or nails or hair. I haven't much property in that respect now, but there we are. You see, it is your property. The brain is your property, but the mind isn't. Mind is this universal sensitivity. You can't catch hold of it. You can't seize it and keep it and say, ah, there's my mind. We have this wonderful phrase, he let him have the other fellow a piece of his mind. Which merely means that he behaved rather badly and stupidly. So now, if the mind becomes empty, is luminous in this sense, what is the significance of this? The person, John Smith, who has realized this state, is still John Smith, of course, identifiable, behaves like John Smith. John Smith, we knew, will carry on in the usual way every day of his life, like all other people in society carry on. But because his mind is empty, and it's luminous, his awareness is not the limited, confined awareness to the body. It is with the mind, in your consciousness, that you realize transcendence and infinitude, the cosmic consciousness, as it is sometimes called. Which means, as I said earlier, there is no sense of otherness. We have the phrase in the language, in all languages in the world, because all people experience this kind of thing. I hold you in my heart. You see? If they put it in the language of feeling, if they put it in the language of thought, they say, I will keep you in mind. Don't we? Those are the phrases we use. I hold you to my, in my heart, or I keep you in my mind, or I am always thinking of you, and this, that, and the other, and so forth. What does that mean? How do I keep you in my mind? Simply, and why is it possible? Simply because mind has no spatial limitations. Mind is a universal reality, like space. But there is this difference between mind and space as we experience it physically, that space is measurable provided there are objects in space. We can get distance. Where the mind is concerned, there is no such thing as distance. Mental relationships are of a totally different nature, therefore, from physical relationships, material relationships. There are no gravitative forces where the mind is concerned. In the material universe, there is gravitative force. But in the world of the mind, what is that? This phenomenon we call telepathy, empathy, sympathy, and so forth. But this doesn't function like gravitation, which is a measurable force, which becomes less with greater distance. But if you have sympathy, love for anyone, whether that person standing in front of you or is in Australia, that is the same. And it is immeasurable. Let us come back to the third part. Oneself is the path, the way. And there is complete confidence in that, because of this strength. The comforter, the spirit of truth, is there within oneself. There is this tremendous confidence. Oneself is the path. The mind is empty, which means that there is no, which implies, amongst other things, there is no sense of otherness with respect to anything that is animate or inanimate. And the third thing which happens, there is no sense of I as property, as my personal property. Instead, there is the overwhelming awareness of I in the sense of totality. You find in all the theologies of, perhaps not all, I'm sorry. But certainly some of the theologies of the world, you will find that God is the all, the totality. Even in the theistic philosophies, God is all in all. Which means that you, the human being who has realized this transcendence, have escaped the bond, the limitations, the confinement within a body. And a self-conception, a limited self-conception, and the only self there is the total self, the absolute all. This is what man can do, which no animal or plant or stone or grain of sand can do. This is what man can do. And it is this kind of awareness which perhaps is the thing that is emerging in the human race as such. It will take its time, but it will be there. Now, that is looking at it in a generalized way. Looking at it as it applies to oneself. How do we regard the self? I. The I is my property. This property sense over the I vanishes. Because property separates. Brigantine is your property, Dilkusha is my property, you see? So and so is your property, etc., etc. It's something which separates. And whatsoever separates is evil, is sin. The sundering of the unity. So when this sense of I as my property, I myself, I belong to myself, you see, when that property sense of the I has gone, then surely this person, through this person, love in its reality, in its transcendent sense, can go out. Otherwise it can't. Otherwise what goes out or is received as love is a pale shadow of the reality, isn't it? It's only the ghost of the reality. You know how it is put in Christian teaching? That Jesus healed because he loved. The love of God, the love of Jesus heals. Does my love heal anybody? Can I say to a fellow, pick up your bed and walk? I can't. I can say it, but I'll make a laughing stock of myself with the result of it, won't I? When this property sense with respect to the I disappears, then through that particular individual, mankind has come to light. This is enlightenment. Mankind has come to light. This is one of the reasons why the Buddha says that the Tathagata is untraceable. He doesn't say that I, Siddhartha Gautama, am the Tathagata. He doesn't say that. He just says. In fact, he says it very positively. I say to you here and now that the Tathagata is untraceable. He who has gone thus, where is he gone? He's not gone away. Anywhere at all. But he has become the all, become Brahma, become Dhamma itself, become the truth itself. And if he has become the truth, become Brahma, become the all, then how can you say, oh, this is the Tathagata, that is the Tathagata? You can say, this fellow is a PhD, that fellow is a BSc, you can do that. But the Tathagata is a degree which cannot be won, cannot be conferred. It is the total isness realizing itself through this person, because this person cleared away the rubbish from inside himself to allow it to happen. If we get the real feel of this kind of thing, are we not here and now in the kingdom of heaven? Is this not the reality of the kingdom of heaven? That is why it was called good news, the gospel, news to delight you, to give you joy. What does the Buddha say? The Dhamma, lovely in the beginning, lovely in the middle, lovely at the end. word lovely in that context has overridingly the feeling of perfection. Say, somebody manufactures a really marvelous motor car, you see, and you say, oh, she's a beauty, she's lovely, you see. But you don't mean that in the sense in which you mean that that girl or that young man is beautiful or handsome. You don't mean it in that sense. That's a different kind of loveliness. Oh, this is lovely, you see. It's so perfect, wonderful. That's what you mean by the word lovely there. And this word kusala and kalyana has that significance. The word used actually, I think, is kalyana. Yes. Kalyana. Lovely. The word kalyana, we use the phrase in Gujarati, for instance, like this, enu kalyan thayu. That means for him his loveliness took place. And it means that he had complete success and all went just perfect. All went perfect. That is the feeling of it. See? So now, realization of this type, realizing means that one is in the kingdom. That one is the Buddha, the enlightened. When I say one is, I'm laboring under the difficulties of language. Through the one, Buddhahood is manifest. That's an awkward way of putting it, but it's more accurate. Otherwise, you get the element of acquisition, attainment, achievement by the individual as an individual attainment, but it isn't. It's the release of a universal reality. Perfection, truth, beauty, wisdom, all these things are universal realities. And what the non-universal can do is to let that universal shine through the particular element. This is the magic of it, the marvel. See, at first one gets a sort of an intellectual excitement about it, and an intellectual delight. There comes the stage when you yourself see it, when you actually see it, and I can assure you this is absolutely true, when you actually see it in that moment, body, mind, feelings, everything is just perfectly calm. There is an extraordinary matter of fact, of course. Of course. Supposing somebody comes here and for some reason or other says, is this a tape recorder? And I say, of course it's a tape recorder. Plain fact. There is a complete ease. This complete ease is one of the inescapable concomitants of the perfect giving way. If the giving way was a giving way because a more powerful force was overriding one, then there is conflict, there is resistance. But you don't completely give way to the transcendent, to God, resisting God. You don't. You become totally unresisting. This total unresistingness is the other side of the coin, so to say, of the infinite resilience of the divine. You see, when one really begins to see these things, not just superficially, one sees superficially because inwardly there's a resistance. Oh no, no, I don't agree with that. I believe so and so, this, that and the other. And after all, for 948 years I've been following this path, I can't give it up because Firozmeta starts chattering a bit of excited nonsense about it. You see, there is that resistance there. Therefore, what is said just enters superficially, affects the top layer of molecules, the top layer of brain cells, and penetrates no further. But if the mind is open, if one is really strong within oneself, one is not afraid. One is not afraid of anything, you see? And one is ready to undergo the transformation as and when it comes, wheresoever it comes. This is very important. So now, when we see that, when the rigidities disappear, all the resistances to truth disappear, and that which is reality manifests itself through the living person. Under those conditions, this word, renunciation, will be seen to be an accompaniment of the process of transformation. I cannot be transformed, my awareness cannot be transformed unless I completely give in. Let the thing happen. Because in the world of the mind, I am invincible. I have only got to be big-headed. And there we are, the other fellow can't do anything about it. But if one is open, really open, watchful, then the comforter is there, the spirit of truth. Now the unwary person will jump up and say, but that's what I've been seeking all the time. And you say, don't seek. Yes. But if I, as I am, in my ignorant, confused state, seek joy, seek bliss, seek perfection, what I'm chasing is my mental image of perfection, bliss, joy, which is imperfection in actual fact, which is far from blissful and joyousness, which is stupidity and ignorance, not enlightenment. See, this is the mistake people make. See, the Buddhist world, for instance, makes its picture of the Buddha. The Buddha is like this and like that and like that. And all those words and thoughts are completely limited by my capacity to conceive in thought, isn't it? So I must let that go. I may take the word, if you like, purely as a sound. Buddhahood, perfection, enlightenment, beauty. But the moment I define it, I have plastered it with my wrong and my evil. I mustn't do that. Take not the name of thy God in vain. How true. Do you see the implications? Tremendous implications. If the I is not to be my little property, dear me, if it is not to be dear me, but to be the beloved absolute, who's prepared to do it? And if we feel from within ourselves, oh yes, I'll have a go at it. Just a bit of bravado, isn't it?